Welcome to Dracena Wines Podcast. Our wines plus your moments equals great memories. I'm your host, Lori, and this is a podcast about all things wine. Today, we traveled across the pond to the United Kingdom. We had a tough time securing the wine for this episode, but the challenge was well worth it. Listen in as we discuss United Kingdom sparkling wine. As we found out, only 4% of the wine is exported, giving a good reason why it was so difficult to find a bottle. Welcome to Wine for Bet Street.
Welcome.
Yay. This was a tough one. We had to do a lot of thinking outside of the box for this one. These letters are getting tough. but we had initially were thinking of doing Umbria, but we've really done a lot of Italy and whatever. So I was really trying to strive, and I wanted to do UK bubbles, and then we weren't going to do UK bubbles, and then we are going to do UK bubbles. So I'm very, very happy. I'm very happy. This is my very first UK sparkling. So
mine too.
I'm really excited to try it. But should we do Elmo first and then we'll drink?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's get into our actual official starting. Doesn't always talk. It's only special times that he talks to us. So, yes, today is UK sparkling. And for those who don't know, I am Lori, and my husband and I own a boutique winery in Paso Robles, California. We really focus in on Cabernet Franc. We do have a rosé of Syrah also. We have two Cabernet Francs that you can choose from. And the rosé is being released to our club members in about 12 days, I think, if my math is correct. And then it will be released later on in April to the general public. We are pretty excited about it. It is like killer. I love it. So please head over to dracenawines.com and check out our wines and all of our accolades. Our Cab Franc received a 91 in the Wine Enthusiast, and both of our Cab Francs got gold medals in the San Francisco Chronicle. And there's a whole bunch of people talking about our stuff online. So just Google us and you can see it. Deb?
I'm Debbie Giaquindo. I'm the Hudson Valley Wine Goddess. I'm a wine blogger, wine writer, restaurateur. I own a restaurant in Stone Harbor, New Jersey. I'm an author of Tapping the Hudson Valley, your guide to the craft beverages of the Hudson Valley. And I'm also co-owner of Happy Bitch Wines. You can find that in upstate New York. And I don't know what else. I'm losing track of everything that I'm doing these days. So right now I'm here on Wine for Bet Street. I know where I'm supposed to be. So I'm glad you all could join us.
So one more thing that I want to announce is that at the time that this will be live, we are just 2 weeks away from our wine pairing dinner that will be at Kitchen 330 in Stone Harbor, hosted by Debbie. And we are excited that our wines will be pouring with the amazing food of Chef Gus. And we are sold out, but you can head over to kitchen330.com and sign up for the wait list. We hope to see you there. And we look forward to talking.
It's going to take place on the top floor of the restaurant. What? And it's going to be a nice, intimate dinner.
Come taste our wine and the amazing food that is being paired with it. So you know what time it is, Deb. I'm dying here. I'm dying. Here we go.
We cheated. We poured. We opened. We did not savor.
We did not savor. Slancha.
Slancha.
It's got a little sweetness to it.
Wow.
Yours looks, I don't know if it's your color, but it looks like it's been aged for a while. It's got the little amber.
Yeah, well, it has been. I probably got this 7 years ago from a wine judge.
Yeah, so.
Who moved over to judge a competition.
There you go. There's some wine education for you right now. Anybody who's watching this, this is a young sparkling, and that is an older sparkling. That is what happens to white wines when they age. So, oh, it does. It has a little sweetness to it. A little sweetness, and but the acidity is like, whoa, my tongue is like salivating.
Mine's kind of on its downward turn, I'll be honest with
you. Yeah.
I'm wondering about that.
Yeah.
There is a little tiny kind of off
is
notes
it
in it, off? But it's not too terribly bad. It's definitely drinkable.
Okay. Are you getting toasty? You know, are you getting toasty? Like not yeast toast, you know, like the caramel?
Yeah, I'm getting a little toast. I'm getting a little of that
age.
I'm at a loss for words.
That age.
But, yeah.
All right.
And I smell it more in the nose. But there's also a fruit flavor in the nose.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, you are supposed to serve sparkling well-chilled. So I took this out about a half an hour ago. So mine is really still well-chilled. So it'll be interesting to see what it evolves into when it warms up just a little bit. Michael, thank you for joining us on No UK Sparkling in the entire northern portion of the state of California. It is not easy to come by at all. I have to give a huge, huge shout out to Jessica Shinnick of Stu Leonard's in Farmingdale, because she got this bottle for me, and it was the last bottle they had in that store. So she pulled it off the shelf, and she held on to it for me. And we did an exchange in Paramus Park Mall, in Paramus Park parking lot. So thank you, Jessica. I appreciate it so much. I appreciate that you grabbed that for me. But so why don't we get started talking about the history of UK sparkling?
U is for United Kingdom sparkling wine. So if I can get the right copy up here, you know, they've been making wine in the UK for quite a number of years. In fact, the British have been making it for over 350 years. However, not from grapes grown in the UK. And there's really no clear data to know when the first sparkling wine was produced in the UK or in England from grapes that were grown there. So they used to, you know, import them from across.
I have some information about that.
Oh, you did? You found that?
I did.
You got that interrupt.
Well, I'll do it when I get to mine, because I don't exactly know where it is in my notes.
Okay.
But they have pinpointed it to a specific person who was the first to plant them.
Okay, but. So I might have that in mind. So let's see here. So it is noted that Christopher Merritt, who is an English scientist and physician, in 1662, said that adding sugar before bottling could sparkle any wine. So that was, I think, the whole start of how the English decided to make their wine sparkle. Then in the Honorable Charles Hamilton, he owned a place called Painshill Place between 1741 and 1779, and he planted a vineyard and grew Pied Rouge, Muscat Blanc, Muscat Rouge, Gillian Blanc, and Savoy. And he employed a French Huguenot refugee named David Genste to take care of the vineyard and make the wine. And in 1754, David wrote to a sister in Bordeaux saying he made 4 barrels of wine and 2 were sold as vin de champagne at 50 pieces or 7 guineas a barrel. By 1775, Hamilton, he had lost the property and moved. I couldn't find out really what had happened, he had lost the property and moved. In 1946, a viticultural research station was founded in, am I not in the right slide here? Hold on a second. Nope. In 1946, a viticultural research station was founded at Oxted, Surrey, by Ray Barrington Brock, and he is said to be the founding father of the modern wine industry in Britain. In the 50s, the first record production of sparkling wine was made by Ray and his partner Edward Haynes. In August of 1960, Brock put on the station's first official trade tasting that included English sparkling wine. So in 1966, a gentleman named Nigel de Marsac Godin planted his first vineyard at Pilton Manor in Somerset. And Graham Barrett in 1967 planted Fellstar Vineyard in Essex. And they were the first commercial producers to make bottled fermented sparkling wines. The main varieties were Muller Thurgau and Sauval Blanc at the time. So it's thought that those were the varieties in the sparkling wine because they didn't label it, kind of like my bottle of wine. But during the 1978 English Wine of the Year competition, the 1976 Fellstar Method Champenois won a silver medal, and a non-vintage Pilton Manor de Marc Brut Method Champenois won a bronze. Now we'll take a look back in 1951. Sir Guy Salisbury Jones at Hambledon was a wine lover, and he suggested to his stepson John to consider planting a vineyard in the field below the house. In 1952, that vineyard was planted, and they brought in Paul Roger from a champagne house in France. In 1966, winemaker Bill Carcari joined the team, and they won a gold medal at the 1984 International Wine and Spirits Competition. Now, these wines have been served, that's the vineyard, they've been served to the Queen, they've been served in Parliament, and they've been exported to the U.S. and Japan. And here we have David and Linda Carl Taylor, who began their vineyard in Westfield on a 21 acre farm in 1971, mostly German varieties, because they felt that they were able to ripen in a cool environment. And most of the grapes they were sent to Lamhurst Vineyards for winemaking. And in 1990, they planted an additional 16 acres. And in 1994, they had their largest crop ever, and so they decided to make their own sparkling wine with the second fermentation in the bottle. And in 1988, they released their first sparkling wine. The vintage sparkling wine won a gold medal at the Concours Européen de Grands Vins, and it beat 1,800 champagnes and sparkling wines made in the traditional method from around the world. Today, their son Alex is the winemaker, and they're keeping it in the family business. So as wine regions begin to, get noticed, other established wineries, houses, decide that they want to come in and partner with people. So Tattinger crossed over and became the first Grand Marquis Champagne House to plant vines in the UK at Domaine Everon in Chilham, Kent. They've been working with leading UK viticulture consultant Stephen Kelton. And they anticipate their first English sparkling wine to be released for Domaine Ormond in 2023, following 3 years aging in the bottle. The Domaine Evermond is an endeavor between Champagne Tattinger and Hatch Mansfield. Is that your wine? Is that your bubbles?
No. Okay. Haddingly.
Okay, combining their family philosophy. Pierre Emmanuel Tattinger believes that the combination of the chalk soil, the climate, and topography in Kent are ideal for producing sparkling wine. And they want to produce 300,000 bottles.
Just a few.
Yes, just a few. So here I just wanted to touch on a few of the wine growing regions, the three areas, main areas. Wine is grown all throughout England, but these are the three main areas. Sussex, it's in the southeastern corner of England. It's the sunniest of all the regions, and it experiences less rain. They have limestone chalk soils, which allows the region to produce really good grapes for sparkling wine. The cool climate helps keep the acidity for the sparkling wine. And then we have Kent with the iconic white cliffs of Dover from the coastline that form the coastline of Kent. Kent's a little bit warmer, and it has the chalk limestone soil. South-facing orientation of the vineyards helps maximize the daylight hours. And Surrey. Here the soil is chalky, made up of the remains of ancient marine fossils. It is where the second Champagne house invested in the land. Pomery and Hattonley Valley partnered to produce sparkling wine. Surrey is home to the largest producer in the UK, Denby Estates.
So that's yours, and Hattonley is mine.
Yeah. And there's a couple of other regions to watch. Hampshire to the west of Sussex is home to UK's first modern commercial vineyard, and East Anglia, which is north and east of London and southwest England. So these are the grapes that are planted. And they talk about the sparkling wine productions. So these are the top grapes planted in England. We have Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Pinot Meunier, Bacchus, Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Blanc, Reichensteiner, Müller Thurgau, and then there's some others. But there's 71.2% of the wines are sparkling. And they use, that accounts for the Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Pinot Meunier. And here we have 4% of all English wine is exported. So that's not a lot.
That's why it's so difficult to get.
No. And the different wine styles, there's 32% of them are still wine and seed, 68% are sparkling wine. So I did find a really great, that's it for me.
So it really is, I didn't get into it very much, but really the whole reason why United Kingdom Sparkling is coming into its own fruition is because of climate change. I mean, you've got to acknowledge that there's something going on. I touch about it a little bit in what I have, but you know, it really is, that's what's happening. And there's a lot of people who are talking about it, who are now saying that, you know, what we're used to, you know, Napa Cabernet, climate change is making it where it may not be Napa Cabernet anymore, that it's going to be, you know, too warm for them to deal with Cabernet. And Champagne is having, you know, it's almost like people are saying that their time has come and now they're starting to go down, and it's English that is coming up, and it's because of climate change. But that we can go on and on over climate change. All right. So we have United Kingdom Sparkling General Characteristics. As of 2014, the UK ranks 6th in the world for overall wine consumption rather than producing it. So it really isn't very odd that most people don't think about England as producing top quality wine. But as you said, in reality, just over 65% of sparkling wine, 65% of the wine made in England is sparkling wine. And with the climate change. The fruit is being able to hang on longer, and we're starting to see quality fruit coming out of these regions. Andrew Jefford, who is an English journalist, radio presenter, poet, magazine editor, wine writer, he does it all, right? He wrote that what once had been regarded as a harmless eccentricity has become, over the last decade, one of the wine's world's most promising developments. The Wine and Spirits Trade Association projects that English sparkling wine production will actually double by the year 2022 to approximately 10 million bottles annually. And with that increase, as you said, it's only like 4 or 5% that is being exported now. By 2022, they're expecting of that 10 million bottles, quarter of those bottles to be exported. So we are going to start to see more and more UK sparkling here in the United States. Just as a general overview, in the United Kingdom, there are about 30, as of 2012, so this is kind of old data, there's 3,500 plus acres, which is just over 1,400 hectares of vineyards. There were 128 wineries, and the first vineyard, which you had said also, was the Hambleton Vineyard in Hampshire, and that was established in 1951. The majority of viticulture takes place, as you said, in the southern region where the climate is slightly warmer and drier. Whether you are on, you know, here we go, whether you're on the side that global warming is happening or it's not happening, something is going on that's making these grapes change their ability to ripen. So what's happening is that the annual temperatures are starting to rise to the point where the grapes are no longer having the issues that they used to have in terms of ripening. The best regions for viticulture are along the southern strip of the England's coast, and it's basically from Cornwall to Kent, which is what you said. So that's pretty much the same map, just a little bit broader of where some more regions are that you did talk about. Grapes used in United Kingdom sparkling are the same three that are used in Champagne: Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, and Pinot Meunier. And additionally, they have their own grape variety, which is Reitschaun Stunner, which is actually the fifth most planted variety in England. And it is an extremely high acid German crossing. So, I mean, to me, that's not really a shock. You're not putting anything that's in a champagne that is in high acid. You know, when you're tasting a sparkling, it's going to be high acid. So they're using Champagne's main three grapes plus their own varietal. However, England sparkling winemakers, although they're using those grapes, they don't want their wines to be like French Champagne. They don't want to be really compared to Champagne. They want to excel. They want to exceed what Champagne has done. So English sparkling has their own niche, and what they feel their niche is freshness. So what they like to say about their sparkling is that it is an electric jolt of acidity infused with bracing minerality and orchard fruit. So the quality of fruit can be highlighted thanks to climate change, with the fact that they are now getting a long, cool growing season. And what's happening is that in July and August, the temperatures are cooling, but the September is warming. So it has interesting implications for the hang time and allowing for the phenolic ripeness that allows those fruit on the vines to really get the full fruit flavors that they could get or that they couldn't have gotten previously. On the nose, what you can typically expect is a toasted caramel brioche aroma with hints of apple, pear, apricot, candy, almonds. To the taste, it is rather similar to champagne, and it is the similar method. They do traditional method. So it offers a clean, crisp, and refreshing acidity, and again, that candied brioche finish. England and the Champagne region actually have very similar climates, with England being just slightly cooler. And again, now that's starting to change. So they are cooler now, but as the global warming continues, it's going to increase. So it's playing, global warming is playing a big part in the agriculture, and it is expected that the warmer weather will continue to increase the quality of the grapes in England. The terroir in these regions of England is very, very similar to Champagne, and the major English sparkling wine regions in the southern England, like Kent, East Essex, and Hampshire, they all have the similarity of the chalk that's beneath the soil. So in England, there's the English Channel, and this has a great impact on the vine growth and the distinct qualities of the grapes in both Champagne and the southern part of England. UK is far more influenced by its coastal environment than Champagne could ever be, but its proximity to the coast is actually what makes the grape growing possible. Climatically, the UK can certainly be described as marginal. It is on the 51st parallel. So that's kind of interesting, because that's really starting to show this global warming thing. So if you look at the main grape growing regions of the world, they lie all between the 30 and the 50 parallel. So England is at the 51st parallel. So now we start to see the big picture, right? They're just out of the norm for it. But with global warming, they're starting to get warmer and warmer, and the 51st is now becoming what was the 50th. So it makes complete sense. And that is what I have for general characteristics.
Very good.
Thanks.
It's interesting how this wine region is starting to evolve.
Yes.
You know, it really is. And how, you know, some of the French houses are coming over.
Mm-hmm. Because they're trying to jump on the bandwagon before it gets. Because, again, if you think about it at 51, you know, parallel, it's not a good grape growing region. Is it horrible? No, you're one latitude off, so it's not a big deal. Uh-huh. But it's like getting into the Kickstarter. You know, they're trying to get in before it becomes a big thing. And right now, it's so difficult to get the sparkling wine here in the United States, which we all have seen how difficult it is to get. But with this production increasing so much, and them on the site of exporting more and more wine, it's going to, you know, eventually it's going to be the thing. And these people are trying to jump in before it becomes the big thing, because it's going to be a lot cheaper now than it was there.
Michael wanted to know about the price points. So the price points, now mine was a gift. And as you can see, it says it was quality food, honestly priced, security protected. I don't know if that's because she smuggled it in her suitcase when she was coming to the States. But I was in a Stu Leonard's liquor store over the weekend in Norwalk looking for V&W, and I started to talk to the manager about the U. And he said he's tasted some of the UK sparkling wines and they're really good. He said, but the price points are very comparable to, you know, champagne. So if you're going to buy a sparkling wine and, you know, for $30, if you can get a bottle of champagne versus a bottle of sparkling wine from the UK, you're going to go with that champagne. So for that reason, he said that that's why they don't carry it, you know, right. because of that reason. So,
right. So
you know,
when you think about it being only 5% of their wine is being exported, that's not a lot, right? So it's being spread very thin here. So there is a competitive price for it. And the way I think Americans think is they're going to walk in and champagne, you know, I can get champagne for $45, right? So Michael, that my bottle, Hattingly is $45. I did receive it as a sample, as a gift also, but it's listed for $45. So an average person who's going to go in and splurge $45 on a bottle, they're going to see champagne and they're going to say, yay, $45. Ooh, that's a bargain. But they're going to see $45 for UK sparkling? Oh.
Right.
Oh.
Those go up in the air. No
I'm not,
way.
Right. I'm not going to pay $45 for that. I'm going to get this. Which, by all means, I personally go with the grower champagne and forget. You know? Like, save yourself money and you're really getting a better deal. And that's really what the wine is. So I think that this price point is going to change. When United Kingdom starts to, you know, show their, you know, peacock up their awards that they're getting and their production is increasing, and now they're going to start be more willing to export more bottles here, I think we're going to see more bottles, which means the price point is going to come down a little bit. And I think that they need to do that as a marketing scheme in order to get people to try it. I don't think people are going to go for United Kingdom sparkling at the same price point of champagne. Whether they know that champagne house or not, champagne has that reputation.
It's got that name.
Right.
You know, and if you can buy it at the same price as sparkling from UK, and nobody really knows about English sparkling wine.
Right.
So they're not going to be willing to risk their $40 on an unknown.
Right. You're going to a party.
No.
You're going to a party and you just spent $45 on a bottle of sparkling and you walk in and it's UK sparkling. The odds are the people at that party are not going to be as oohed and awed. Even though the wine is spectacular, they're not going to be oohed and awed as if you walked in and spent $35 on something that says champagne.
Champagne, right. So.
And now, a word from our sponsor. Apropos, the club is simple, yet a bit different than most. When you wager on us, we will ship you 3 bottles of wine twice a year, once in April and once in September. You can choose all red or mix of red and rosé. You immediately receive 15% off of all your wine purchases throughout the year, but what makes our club stand out is the progressive discount. Let your club membership ride into the next year. Your discount increases. Each year you parlay your membership, you receive an additional 5% off up to a planned maximum of 25%. Your club shipments are discounted to a flat $15, plus we'll cover your club shipping cost for your second shipment. That's $15 house money in a sure bet for you. So please head to our website, DracenaWines.com, and find out all of the benefits of joining the Chalk Club and how to sign up. We've stacked the odds so that you can get our award-winning wines without breaking the bank. So
do you want to talk about your
Sure, absolutely. So once again, I would love to give a huge, huge shout out to Jessica Shinnick of Stu Leonard's in Farmingdale, New York. She got this for me, and thank you. So this is my bottle. Okay, so this is a Hattingley Valley Classic Reserve. And it weighs in at 12% alcohol, okay? And as I said, I received it as a gift, but online I found it to be about $45. All right, so Hattingley Valley was actually founded in 2008 by Simon and Nicola Robinson, and they are in Hampshire, England, with its chalky soils and climate ideally suited for sparkling wines. So they actually planted their first 7.3 hectares on the south-facing site, and they did Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Pinot Meunier using laser-guided planting technology. I do not know what laser-guided planting technology is, other than maybe they had one of those laser levels, and they could see the... Bless you.
Thank you.
They could see, you know, whatever. So today they have about 24 hectares, which is about 60 acres of vines across 2 sites. So they are actually led by, a female winemaker, Emma Rice. And Hattingley Sparkling Wines are all made in the traditional method with the highest quality standards. Highest quality standards. And they are part of the leading movement for English sparkling wines. They are part of it. So Hampshire, England itself is located in the central south. Hampshire benefits from the chalky limestone soil and the cool climate conditions that are very, very similar to Champagne. Hampshire is home to the first established commercial wine producer, which, as you said, was founded in 1951. And the best vineyards tend to be south-facing, which benefits from the sun exposure. So this wine here, the Hattingly Classic Reserve, is actually 48% Chardonnay, 33% Pinot Noir, 17% Pinot Meunier, and then 2% actually Pinot Gris. The fruit is actually sourced from the vineyards across the south of England, all the chalky soil, chalky and clay soil. As for the wine itself, all the grapes are harvested and sorted. 25% of the total blend was barrel fermented for 3 and 4 years in white, Burgundy, and Bordeaux barrels, so neutral or at least 1 year, giving the wine texture and richness. The wine then spent 8 months. I take that back. That might not be true. They might have just purchased new white Burgundy, but to me, when you say white Burgundy, that makes me think it's a used barrel. Giving the wine texture and richness. The wine then spent 8 months on fermentation on the lees, and they did no batonnage, no stirring, no addition of sulfur dioxide. They did obviously top off because of the Angel's Share. And then final blending was done, and the wine spent 21 months aging. So as I said, it's 12% dosage, and it's got 9 grams per liter. I'm sorry, 12% alcohol, and the dosage is 9 grams per liter. So that's pretty low. So that's a brut, if my math and memory is correct. But this has a hint of sweetness to it for me. I do get yeast. I do get the toast. But it is like apricot, fresh, like, you know, like jam. No, I take that back. Not jam. Like an apricot. If you just bit into that apricot, that, you know, that's what it's got.
It's the apricot.
Yeah. And it's got some apple to it. I don't know. I like it, but, you know, in all honesty, and Mike thinks this is hysterical, in all honesty, I am not a champagne fan.
I
don't like that toast, that yeast, that.
I know, get you on that. Paul loves it.
Yeah, I'm not
that big. I don't like it big and bready.
Right.
I like hints.
Right.
Right. Subtle hints.
Right. So I'm more of a sparkling that is done in the traditional method. But again, I'm going back to, I will take a grower champagne because I find more grower champagnes that I like. And I don't know why, because they're doing it in that same method. And it's from the same area. It is the same area, but there's whatever they're doing, they're not so much. But when I walk through a store, I don't really go to the champagne. I don't really go to the champagne aisle. I'm more of a sparkling fan, but that is my wine.
Okay. So my wine is from Denby's.
Do you get the chocolate?
My bottle. Now this was a gift. I used to drive one of the wine dredges from the Classic back to Poughkeepsie because her sister lived in Dover or Pawling. And one year she brought me this back. And I think I waited too long. She wanted me to try the sparkling wine. And, you know, just sat in my cellar. And I think it's definitely on the downside. So I think in its prime, this was probably really, really good.
That's actually, that's almost a dark amber, medium amber,
It is. It smells like it's old. I don't know how else to describe it. Like there is that off notes in it, but it's not completely, like, there's other stuff fighting to get heard. So it's not totally.
It's not gone, but it's on its downside.
But it's definitely on its downside. And they make this only with the grapes, it says here. They only make this in limited release, producing only in the best of seasons using the finest grapes. I don't know what the grapes are in it because I couldn't find it online either. But it is 12% alcohol. You gotta see the, I'm gonna go into what this is, but the little logo there, what it means. So it's a cute little thing. Mm-hmm. So Denny's is quite a tourist attraction, I will tell you that. When I was looking for, you know, for information, there's a brewery there's lodging there.
Sign me up.
There. Yeah, right? So it's quite the estate. You can have your private corporate events there. They do a ton of events. They give you a lot of information. They have a farm shop. They have a brewery. There's tons of information just on the town and where they're located and things to do. So I give them a lot of credit. But the Denby's was sold to Jonathan Tyers. Let me go back. So the first owner was Mr. Wakefield, and he sold the property to Jonathan Tyers, who sold it to Thomas Cubitt in 1850. And it was in the Cubitt family until 1984. So that's quite a long time. In 1984, Denby's was purchased by Sir Adrian White, who is the founder of the British engineering company Bywater. In January of 1986, they planted their vineyard. And let me tell you, the Queen visits this place a lot, or has visited this place a lot. I'm not going to tell you how many times because it would just bore you. But the royal family visits this place. January 1993, the winery opened. They have a 2000 gallery restaurant, a 2001 farmhouse bed and breakfast. In 2000, the gallery restaurant opened. In 2001, the farmhouse B&B opened. In 2004, the Queen came back. Summer of 2009, James May's Lego house was built in the vineyard.
Lego house?
Legoland?
Legoland?
Legos. Kids' Legos, yeah.
Right.
So in January of 2010, the first English Sauvignon Blanc was planted at Denby's. 2011, Camilla came to visit. See, the royal family likes this place. So the estate has 627 acres, 200 of which are woodlands, and 10 estate houses, and 265 acres are planted with grapes. The vineyard is situated in the Surrey area, North Downs, in the town of Dorking. So I'm not sure if that's the right way to say, like, the address or towns and, you know, areas. But they do have the famous chalky soil. They have south-facing slopes with a warm microclimate. So it's kind of ideal, they find, for growing grapes. Let me talk a little bit about the logo on the bottle. So you saw the stars. Let me see here. So there's the hand and the stars. Let me get so I can see.
Okay.
Hand and the stars. Okay. So the stars represent the fresh and exciting opportunities they add to their diverse products and services. and the hand reaching towards the stars represents their desire to strive for five-star excellence. And the hand itself represents the unique and personal relationship they value with everybody involved in Denby's. So, if you're in the UK and you're in the Surrey area, I definitely would check this place out. They have things going on all the time. They have a bed and breakfast, restaurant, brewery. I mean, I think the brewery's in the town. They've really got it all. As far as the taste of the wine, it tastes like it's on the downside. But then there's like this twang at the end, like of a citrus, you know, trying to show itself. So I'm just sad. Sometimes, you know, this happens when you sell our stuff and you forget you have it. And there's
but
nothing you can do about it.
It worked out well because now you had a UK sparkling for this.
Well, I did. I had the UK. And remember I said, yeah. I don't know if it's good. And I could have sworn Paul and I had drank it, but obviously we do not. Yeah.
So the other thing I wanted to point out was both Debbie and I, not that people who are listening to the podcast can know this, but people who are watching this on YouTube or live, notice that we are both drinking it out of a white wine glass. Okay, so here's the thing. We all know that when you see it in the movies, everybody has, the old school is that... what the heck do they call that thing? The No.
The coupes.
The coupes, right? So old school was the coupes, okay? Then we went to the flute. And if you actually study wine, they tell you that the proper glass to drink sparkling or champagne wine is to do a flute. It is not true. It is not true. You actually do want to drink a sparkling wine out of a white wine glass. You want to be able to capture the essences. So you don't want a red wine glass where all that essence is going to fly, you know, go out where you can't get it into your nose. But you want the white wine glass in order to contain the bubbles and give you the best expression of that sparkling. But this is not as woohoo celebration as a flute is. So, Debbie.
No, yeah. I agree. And it's funny is at the restaurant, when people come in with sparkling wine, I give them the choice if they want a flute or a regular wine glass. And then they say why. And then I tell them, and they will take the regular wine glass. But some people are kind of snooty and will only take it in a flute.
Right. It is.
Oh, that's fine. That's their preference.
Yep. It is. It is more celebratory. In a flute, it looks all wonderful in the flute, but you really are missing out on a lot if you are drinking a sparkling or a champagne in the flute. So give it a try, you know.
And actually, this is actually a Riedel sparkling wine glass.
Oh, is it? There you go.
It is.
So, you know, next time you go out and you buy a sparkling or, you know, a champagne, you know, do a side by side. Grab your flute and grab a white wine glass, or if you have the Riedel, you know, sparkling glass, go ahead and do a taste comparison, and you will see you'll have a much better experience in the smaller glass, not the flute.
I've done it in all three, and it was really an interesting tasting and nose smelling and everything.
Right. And the coupe, is nice. I would prefer the coupe over a flute. But the problem with the coupe is that it is so big that everything goes out. And there's so much exposure that you lose those bubbles so quickly. Which is why people use the flute. Because everybody wants that sparkling. Everybody wants that champagne. Oh, look at the bubbles. Look at the bubbles.
But you can still see these bubbles. I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, these...
I poured these before we even started because I got anxious.
Oh, well, I'm like multiple glasses in, but the bubbles are still going. But in a flute, the bubbles are going to be prettier, without a doubt. So if you're going to take a picture, by all means, put it in a flute. Put it in a flute because the bubbles are there and whatever. And as a sidebar, because, you know, science geek that I am, right, we all know that bubbles are carbon dioxide, right? That's what's in. But do you know that you can't see bubbles in the glass? That what allows you to see the bubbles in the glass, or what allows you to see the carbon dioxide bubbles, is actually imperfections. So you cannot have, the glass has imperfections in it. The little bit of dust that's there, little scratches that are on there, all that. That's what catches the carbon dioxide, and then it creates the bubble, and that's what allows you to see the bubble. So there you go. You have to have imperfections to have a perfect bubble.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, shall we move on?
We shall. How about you? You've got food pairings.
Okay. So I tried to pair English sparkling with English food.
Ah.
So I did. I, you know.
This was probably rather difficult because there's so much that sparkling can go with.
Oh, my God, yes. You know, so I tried to keep it to the foods of England.
Okay.
So here, you know, we have strawberries and cream macaroons.
But that's French.
Yeah, but that's just right across. That's for the French-inspired sparklings in the UK. So here are gravlax or salmon. Smoked salmon on toast with creme fraiche with a Chardonnay-based sparkling. And then here we have, okay, so I went off the rails here. duck spring rolls with a Pinot Blend sparkling.
Oh, okay.
And then fried chicken.
I tell you, fried chicken and sparkling is the pairing, apparently.
Isn't that awesome? I went out for dinner here to a place that is known for fried chicken. Mm-hmm. And I brought a bottle of sparkling. And Jen's like, why sparkling? I go, the acidity and the grease, you got to have it. She's like, oh, my God, this is a wonderful pairing.
Yep.
Definitely. Fish and chips. Got to have the fish and chips.
Fish and chips.
Will pair really well with that.
Again, sparkling wine is actually a very high acidic wine. So fried foods, the acidity cuts through that fat. So,
yeah, it's great. And here we have a little crab pate. And here we have some seafood and sausage paella. So I tried my best to keep it to British, but, you know.
But, you know, you don't, right. It doesn't need to be British in order to pair with it.
Yeah,
you know.
But it's well-rounded here, you know.
Yes.
I'm trying to show that it goes with a lot of different things.
Absolutely.
Your fried food, your pate, seafood, paella.
Absolutely.
So.
Yes, excellent
job. So definitely,
job.
You know, when you don't know what to grab, grab a sparkling.
Yep, it is. And don't forget popcorn. You didn't have popcorn in there.
That's right. I didn't put popcorn in there. Sorry.
All right. So we are coming to the end of this month's Wine from Bette Street, and we always end with the fast facts. So here we go. Buyer beware. British wine and English wine are not the same thing. A label boasting British wine is typically a sweet port style or sherry style wine made from imported grape concentrate. It is cheap. So, I mean, if you like it, good for you, but be aware that that's not the same thing. Okay? Know what you're buying. Late in 2015, Champagne House Tattinger announced its purchase of land in Kent, intending to plant Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Pinot Meunier on its newly acquired site. Tattinger is the first champagne producer to jump on the English sparkling boom and invest in the country's burgeoning wine industry. 1980s and early 90s, pioneering British producer Nytimber, followed closely by Ridgeview, took the bold and brave step of planting Chardonnay and Pinot Noir vines with the clear vision of producing top quality sparkling wines. So that's what I had mentioned early on in the thing. They are actually the first people to plant with the clear perception of making a sparkling wine. So fact number four, quality English sparkling wine will be made in the same traditional method that champagne is made in. It is typically from Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Pinot Meunier, and with a minimum of 9 months aging on lees, which is different, okay, because champagne is 12. And the 12 to 24 months is more common. So their regulation is 9 months, although most of the houses that are producing sparkling go over that. And in fact, the majority of them are 12 to 24, and there are a few producers that actually go all the way out to 36 months. And our last fast fact, you can expect to spend between $35 to $50 for a bottle of UK sparkling, which is not a bad price to quality issue. But as we said earlier, I think they're going to run into an issue of just going up against champagne. You can get champagne, right? You can get champagne for that same price. And until, you know, they're the new kids on the block.
Known versus unknown is really what it is.
Right.
And until they come and they do more education, mm-hmm. you know, and tastings and stuff.
Yeah, I think that's their biggest issue is they're breaking into a new world for them. And, you go marketing wise, you got to do something that separates you from the others. And uh-huh. I think they're going to have a problem if their price is the same as champagne. I personally like this. I think it's a very nice sparkling. It can go with a lot of stuff. It's very champagne like. I've got the toast. I've got that lees. I've got that. But I think an average consumer is not going to spend that money when they can spend that same amount of money on to get the name of champagne. I don't know. People can write in and tell me I'm wrong.
I don't know. I don't know either, but I do know that was one of the gentlemen at Stu Leonard's that I talked to in Norwalk, Connecticut, said exactly that. It's a tough sell.
Right. And Michael just said, so much sparkling in Northern California, and it will be tough with their current price point. So I agree with that.
I agree.
I'm not spending, $45 Domaine Carneros. I mean, I will take that any day, any night the week.
Me too.
And
me too.
It's there. It's simple. It's complex. It's a beautiful wine. Gloria Ferrer, again, and I think that's cheaper. I think that's like $30. My favorite that Mike buys me for Christmas, ooh, Santa brings me under the tree for Christmas every year, is Etiole, and that's $40. So I think that's high on the price, but I know that. I love that. It's, I think they're going to have trouble at the price point. That's their problem. It's not the quality. It's definitely not the quality. It's the price point.
So we move on to what we're going to do next month.
Yes.
So I suck at pronouncing these things. So I'll leave that to you.
We are letter of the day is V. And
V.
V. And it is Val d'Igoux. I don't know. I really don't know how to say that one because I didn't Google it. See, I always Google how to pronounce things.
I do too.
So I did not Google that. But it is basically, it was presumed to be Gamay. It is not Gamay, but it is in that same family. So we can predict it's going to be very Beaujolais-like, which we did Letter of the Day of B, our very second episode of Wine for Bet Street was Beaujolais, and so we spoke about Gamay there. So I have a feeling it will be very similar to that. But that date is, because that's you.
Oh, that date is April 15th.
No, it's Monday, not. April 15th. It Tax is day. Not April 15th, because I will be in Cancun, and I don't care. I am not doing Wine for Bet Street.
Okay, so we will change it. There we go.
I love Wine for Bet Street. I love doing the education, but I will be sitting... not doing Wine for Bet Street from Cancun.
So let's see. What's the following one?
Do you want to do it the following one?
I'm bringing up a calendar. My internet's kind of going slow.
All right.
April. I'll change the date on it. April 22nd?
Earth Day. Sure. April 22nd works for me.
Whose birthday?
Oh, it's Earth Day.
Oh, okay.
It's the Earth's birthday.
Okay, so April 22nd. So you're going to have some nice color at the wine dinner.
I will. Hopefully. Well, more than likely it will be a red color because Irish yes. and sun do not go well together. It pisses me off. Mike goes out there for like 1 hour and becomes dark, and I go out for 10 minutes and am a lobster. But my philosophy every time we go is for every hour I'm out in the sun for 10 minutes and under the umbrella for 50 and I'm kind of okay.
You're going to be with your husband. Have a great time.
All is good. Yeah. Yes. So
thank you everybody.
Yes. Thank you for joining and hope to see you next month. And again, April 22nd, just 4 days before the wine tasting dinner at Kitchen 330. Right. So if you are in New Jersey, you know, or Philadelphia, or, you know, Pennsylvania,
or New York,
Delaware, you know, or New York,
Pearl Harbor, Cape May area for the weekend, and Friday night, start your weekend off by Michael with me and Lori.
Yeah.
At the Justina Wines dinner at Kitchen 330.
Yeah. So thanks everybody for joining, and hope you can, if you do find some United Kingdom sparkling, please let us know. Give us a, you know, shout out and let us know what you think about it. All right?
Definitely. Let us know your thoughts.
All right.
Take care.
Bye, Slancha. Thanks for listening to Dracaena Wines Podcast. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like us to discuss, please reach out to us on social media. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, YouTube, Facebook, Snapchat, Google, and Periscope as @DracaenaWines. I am also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoyt Budd, or email us at DracaenaWines.com. If you enjoyed our podcast, please subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcast catcher to help others find us more easily. We are found on all of your favorite aggregators. To subscribe easily to iTunes, go to bit.ly/DracaenaPodcast. That's bit.ly/DracaenaPodcast. And that's a capital D for Dracaena and capital P for podcast. Please check out our award-winning wines and find out about our wine club at DracaenaWines.com. And remember to always pursue your passion. Slancha!